Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. A lot to talk about today, and we have a full house to talk about issues on the national level as well as what's happening here in Georgia. Joining me, as he does on Mondays and Fridays, my colleague Jim Galloway, lead political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Wednesdays and Sundays are the day you read his column in the newspaper, but you also can read him at the Political Insider blog as part of Politically Georgia at myajc.com. Hi, Jim.
Good afternoon. It's a busy one.
Yeah, it's a busy day. We've already been sitting here. I've been sitting here, and our producers, Tom Faust, and I've been really looking over the news as it's coming in, and we'll start talking about it in a minute. But let me also welcome Julianne Thompson. She is a Republican who's been active in conservative politics in the state, active in Republican Party leadership over the years, one of the founders of a Tea Party organization back in around 2009, 2010. Thank you for being here, Julianne. It's always a pleasure to see you. Former Democratic Congressman from Cobb County, Buddy Darden, is back with us. Buddy, we're glad that you could be here. Our listeners always enjoy you on this show.
I always enjoy being on this great show.
Heath Garrett is a Republican political consultant. He works very closely with U.S. Senator Johnny Isaacson and works on legislative matters, a government affairs firm, Strategic
Partners and
Media. Thank you, Heath. And we have a couple. This is a Cobb County crowd. We've also got Michael C. Owens, who is the chairman of the Cobb County Democratic Party. Thank you for being here, Michael.
I'm happy to be here. First time being here on a Monday, actually.
Wow.
About a year and a half.
So. Very. Okay. Well, we're glad you're here. Before we do anything else, a quick shout out to the League of Women Voters of Coastal Georgia. Jim, we had a wonderful evening
show
with them Thursday night when we went down to Savannah to record Political Rewind with them. And Cuffy Sullivan, who's the president of the league and put it all together, she was just a joy
and
to
the crowd,
work with.
We had a packed crowd.
300 plus people.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was nice. It was very nice. So thank you to the league and to the people of Savannah for turning out in such big numbers for us, buddy.
I caught the show the next day on the way back from Cartersville on GPB, and it was a great show, and I congratulate you on it.
All right. Well, thank you. All right. Let's talk. The president rolled out two significant measures today. One is his plan for what's being called a $1 trillion infrastructure bill. We'll talk about what that means in a moment. But he also rolled out his budget. This is the White House's idea of where we ought to spend and where we ought to cut. But Galloway, as you've already said, this is not going to live as it starts out.
No, but it is an ideological statement.
That's exactly
right. And as an ideological statement, it says that President Donald Trump doesn't believe in erasing the deficit or even taking even lowering it.
And that's what we're going to get into. So let me give you just a few figures and then let everybody weigh in. It's a $4.4 trillion budget. It's got steep cuts in domestic programs and entitlements, including Medicare, big increases for the military, but it envisions, as Jim just said, $7.1 trillion in new debt over the next decade. Just to give you a couple more details before we open it up to everybody else, the budget would add $984 billion to the federal deficit next year, and then it goes on and includes the $200 billion, not $1 trillion, but $200 billion for infrastructure spending. So let's talk about it. Heath Garrett, I want to come to you very quickly if I can, because one piece of good news for your friend Johnny Isaacson, who's the chair of the Veterans Affairs Committee, is the budget does include a request for $85.5 billion in discretionary funding for medical care for veterans, which would be good news to Chairman Isaacson.
Absolutely. And it's good news for our veterans, right? The one of the few bipartisan issues over the last couple of years has been Veterans Affairs reform. Having Senator Isaacson as the chair has been crucial not only to the state of Georgia, but also for the entire nation. Matter of fact, when people thought nothing got passed last year, actually Johnny Isaacson was the only member of the Senate to get four pieces of legislation passed, including a major reform of the Veterans Affairs Medical Services. And now the president is actually putting money in his budget behind those reforms, which we think should accrue to the benefit of the hundreds of thousands, if not nearly a million, veterans who make Georgia their home.
All right. On the other hand, Tamar Hallerman, your colleague up at the AJC Washington Bureau, Jim, tweets that Georgians have a reason to be disappointed because the Savannah Port funding, which they wanted, I guess they wanted at least $100 million in this coming fiscal year. They need eventually like $1 billion, and instead they got $49 million so far. That hurts because
this was started under the partnership of Nathan Deal and Kasim Reed. Kasim Reed is no longer mayor of Atlanta, of course, but with Donald Trump in the White House, Republicans said, "Oh, this ought to be a no sweat deal." And it's just not happening.
Yeah, what's going on here? Why would we think that this is a Republican state? It's a state that supported Trump by pretty good margins. I mean, not overwhelming, not as big as other states, but I mean, you would think he'd want to do more for Georgia.
Well, like the Stones used to sing, you always don't get what you want. And
or something like that. And,
but can we get what we need?
And in this case, you got to remember that this is the president's wish list, and this is subject to annual appropriations and congressional action. And this might finally be the opportunity that Congress has been looking for, not just where the port is concerned, but generally speaking, to assert itself as a co-equal branch of government. Because Congress throughout the years has been diminished more and more in its influence in the government. And this might be the time for them to take a stand and say, we're going to establish priorities and not the President of the United States.
This is going to set back if this figure remains. And as a expression of the president's will, Michael, this could set back the work on the harbor for some time to come.
Yeah, it could, and hopefully that it won't. But as Congressman Darden was saying, I mean, I think overall this is the president's vision, right? And because Congress controls the purse strings, we look at it as a way as how he would like the administration and the government to go. And to me, that's where the problems are, right? Increased military spending. I don't think anyone's mentioned the fact that he wanted to slash EPA by 34%.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Reduction in costs or a reduction in spending for the United States State Department, which is huge. And cutting back on USAID. So, you know, again, his trending in increasing military spending at the same time and cutting for diplomatic efforts across the world is problematic.
Well, I think we kind of have to see. I mean, I haven't had time to look through the budget yet, of course. But I think we need to see exactly where those cuts are targeted when it comes to the State Department. Are they administrative cuts, or are they actually dealing with diplomatic outreach? And I would doubt very seriously that they are. But I think that President Trump I think that President Trump is learning that governing and campaigning are very different from each other.
Well, if it's true that he's looking at cutting entitlements like Medicare, which he promised throughout the campaign he would not touch, then he is learning there's a difference between governing and campaigning. That will be really interesting to watch unfold. Mitch McConnell doesn't want to touch entitlements like Medicare and Medicaid, but Paul Ryan has been licking his chops to get a chance to do that, Julianne.
No, I agree, and we'll just have to wait and see what happens. But like I said, he campaigned on being the candidate for people who were tired of politicians that campaign one way and govern another. But actually, when you get into office and you see what the problems actually are, it's a whole different story to govern.
Well, and this always brings up the debate, too, particularly on entitlements. Are they really cuts, or are we slowing the rate of growth of those entitlements?
It's always the argument, isn't
exactly.
It?
And so my friends on the left always refer to those as cuts. I do think there are some cuts in our foreign policy expenditures that are true cuts, right? They're literally removing personnel and reprioritizing those dollars to the military and to other programs. I think on entitlements, probably what we're doing is slowing the growth. And if we're ever going to touch the debt, we're going to have to figure out how to do that. And I like the fact that Paul Ryan's at least said, we're going to do it.
My money's on Mitch McConnell. I've been watching this thing for a number of years, and when it all comes down to it, the Congress does not have the guts or the inclination to do anything to entitlements, not just to cut the rate of growth, but to do anything, period, Heath. And in my opinion, there's going to be a lot of talk about it, but in the end, Ryan's going to fold, and Trump's not going to be nowhere to be found when the final decision is to be made.
Yeah, we've got some specific items in there, like food stamps. The SNAP SNAP program is being cut there. But then you have to, and this is something that Sonny Perdue would oversee, which is interesting. But then you have to figure in that we've also got a farm bill coming up, and that farm bill is going to have to get passed. And you don't get that farm bill passed unless you have some urban support for food stamps.
You're absolutely right. This has really been the reason that we've been able to get farm bills throughout the years, is the urban people have to come along because the SNAP program or food stamps is a major, major part of it. And once you decouple that, as Paul Ryan has attempted to do on several occasions, the whole scheme is going to fall apart.
I don't want to miss the forest for the trees here. I really especially want to turn to our two Republicans on the panel to start this. This doesn't sound like a Republican proposal at all. I mean, when you're talking, Julianne and Heath, about a budget which, coupled with the $1.5 trillion in tax cuts that the Trump administration got through Congress, you're looking at a staggering sum, $7 billion, to be added to the deficit. This is not the way Republicans think about the economy, is it, Julianne?
Well, I think that there is definitely going to be some backlash from a lot of Trump's base. But at the same time, Donald Trump didn't necessarily run as an ultra-right conservative. He ran as more of a populist. So we'll just have to wait and see how his base responds
to
this.
But Heath, it's the Republican Congress that seems to be taking the plunge with him.
Well, I do want to make the stimulative argument, right, as an economic Republican, and I have been all my life, primarily because of the belief that, all of this has been scored in a way that does not take into account the growth in economic activity that will, most bipartisan folks say, that this tax package will take into effect. And so I do think that that would be the Republican argument for it. But what I like about this budget is, unlike Democratic and Republican budgets in the past that lied to us, that said they were going to eliminate deficits and debt, he's actually being honest.
But here's where he contradicts you, Heath. The tax cut that was passed in December was all based on the fact that, from the Republican point of view, that it would spur economic growth. But if you take a look at what we've read so far of his budget proposal, it denies that growth is going to take place.
And I would just say that I agree with what Heath said, but as true as it may be, if we don't have the right kind of messaging coming from the White House and from the Republican Party on this, it's not going to matter. So,
am I correct in the fact that Donald Trump once called himself the king of debt?
Yes,
right?
He did.
So being in debt and running up huge debts is nothing new to him and nothing he really doesn't see as a problem. I mean, over $1 billion in debt, I think he had over his career. So by taking the nation in this way, it's not a conservative principle, but it's one that he's had throughout his entire career.
Buddy?
Well, as much as I respect my friend Heath, I do think this economic stimulative argument is a lot of bunk, because if you spend more money, you've got to have more revenues to cover it. And I remember everybody has expostulated this for years and years and years, but it simply doesn't work. It didn't work under President Reagan. It didn't work until Bill Clinton came in and raised revenues and actually managed to balance the budget with a small surplus.
Let's look at the other big item that the president rolled out today, Jim, and that's the infrastructure bill. He promised throughout the campaign that he was going to spend $1 trillion to let America rebuild its crumbling infrastructure, bridges, roads.
And this is very Trumpish. He's going to let other people spend $1 million.
A trillion dollars. Yeah, just to make the point, Jim, and you elaborate on it. We've known about this for some time, but it's finally set in stone for the time being. What he's proposing is that the federal government will pony up $200 billion, and he does believe it's a trillion-dollar effort, but only when they only because that goes toward matching funds, public-private partnerships in many states.
And that would be, pardon my math, but that's a 4-to-1 match, and that's going to take a lot of persuasion. And number one, I don't think states are at the level where they can do that right now, where they can say put in $2 for every dollar. Look where it's gotten us with the Port of Savannah. I mean this is not a formula that we're going to have a whole lot of that Georgia is going to have a whole lot of confidence.
Yeah, you know, Michael, when the president first started talking about public-private partnerships to do infrastructure, rightly or wrongly, Democrats were suspicious. They said, whoa, this is just a way that the president sees giving his pals mm-hmm. who are in the construction yes. business, contractors, these people an opportunity to feed at the public trough. Yes. And that's been the complaint about the notion of public-private partnerships in rebuilding roads and rebuilding bridges and that sort of thing.
Right. Well, I mean, public-private partnerships can work and should work, and they should be a viable option that's on the table. But we have to make sure that's done in the right way. We have to make sure that it's not the whole pay-for-play, you know, and where corruption starts to really creep into that. But as I guess we'll talk about later with the expansion of broadband, there's other things that kind of come into that when you have to look at public-private partnerships.
Julianne, are you confident that the president, that states will be able to come to the table with the money that's required to, I think about the many, many projects that Georgia needs aside from the port, and it strikes me it's really putting a huge burden on the state budget to do something.
Well, it does put a burden on the state budget, but the fact of the matter is when it comes to infrastructure, when it comes to roads and bridges, those are the responsibility of the government. And I have a difficult time with some of my fellow Republicans that do not understand that. And when we're talking about taxes that specifically deal with infrastructure, that's something that we can't do for ourselves. That's something that the government will do. So I hope that states can keep up. But
I'm sorry. Finish your thought.
No, it's fine.
Buddy,
Georgians don't like tolls.
Well, let me just point out, David Ralston was among those who went to Washington today to be part of this rollout of the infrastructure plan. So here's the Georgia speaker saying he appreciates President Trump's emphasis on public-private partnerships, and he thinks that will help address the nation's infrastructure needs. So, I mean, maybe that's just the pro forma thing you say when you're called upon by the White House to be in the room after when the president speaks, but he's the one who's going to have to figure out a way to pay for it.
And I was about to say, Georgians don't like tolls. And once tolls reach a certain percentage of the income to do the roads, people will start avoiding those toll roads even. So I'm not sure what we're going to do, except I don't see the state of Georgia making a substantial investment, 3 or 4 times what the feds are going to do. What about you, Heath?
Well, first of all, I want to go back and say we are talking about $200 billion in additional new funding for infrastructure. So we're acting like that's nothing. That's a significant amount. And we can't say we're being fiscally irresponsible one moment, we're being fiscally responsible the next. There is a leverage effect. It works very well in places all over the world, including in other places in other states like Florida and other things. So one of the reasons I think Speaker Ralston is there is because Georgia actually may be in one of the best positions to leverage some of that money because we've already dealt with transportation funding in a politically courageous way by the governor and the legislature just a couple years ago. And on top of that, several of our metropolitan counties and our rural counties already have SPLOST dollars that are in the pipeline for the next few years, not just in Atlanta, but all across middle Georgia. And those dollars can be used to leverage. So some of our communities are going to be in a better shape than we think.
All I can say is that Congressman Darden and I, and maybe you when you were really a little boy, Jim Galloway, we remember when President Eisenhower built the interstate highway system, and buddy, he did that with federal money.
Almost exclusively. I believe it was 90-10 federal money.
Okay, now Heath listed some advantages. I would throw one more in there, and that is Sonny Perdue. Because if the federal government goes heavy into broadband, it's likely to be through the auspices of the Department of Agriculture, which he heads up.
And we are going to, that you gave me the perfect segue. We've got to get a break in. We are going to talk about rural broadband because the Trump plan has some money for rural broadband. But we've seen this week at the legislature a new proposal that would help get us some state tax dollars for broadband as well. So let's get to that. When we come back from this break, this is Political Rewind.
Now is the perfect time to clean out the garage and get rid of that car you no longer need. You'll face the coming months with a fresh start, and by donating your used car to GPB, you'll even get a tax deduction. Call 877-GPB-1-CAR or donate securely online at gpb.org/cars. And thanks. I'm gonna get in my car.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Buddy Darden, Julianne Thompson. Somebody's yelling in the background. I wasn't in this studio, though. Michael Owens, Heath Garrett, and Jim Galloway. Jim, I don't want our listeners to think that we're torturing anyone in the room today.
An angry giraffe.
Jim, the president's budget does have a fair chunk of money to help states develop rural broadband. And that's become a huge priority here in Georgia, where the House put together a task force, a study group, to figure out how we can close this tremendous gap between the economy of rural Georgia and urban areas like Metro Atlanta. And of course, rural broadband became one of the most important items on that list. And now there's a proposal at the Capitol for how to raise some money to do that.
And the important thing to know is who's the chief sponsor, and that's Jay Powell. He's the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, which means taxes are involved. And this is a tax increase. This would be a new tax on all sorts of internet-related purchases.
Telephones. Julianne, we'll let you get in here. Telephones.
In an election year.
Amazon. Streaming, Netflix, digital music streaming, ebooks. Julianne?
Right. I have to learn more about this particular bill, but from what I understand it, it is that this is not necessarily a new tax or a tax increase, but a revision of what already exists. And Hulu and Netflix and a lot of the other companies that were not part of, I believe it's called the Communication Services Tax, from what I could understand, and I might be wrong, but from what I understand, they were not involved in this before, and since that's where the growth is, that's where the new growth is, they were added to this. And so, I have to learn more about it, but as a conservative, that supports a consumption tax over an increase of income taxes and actually supports eventually doing away with income taxes, state income tax, I support a consumption tax. So I really want to learn more about this before I go into full criticism mode on it.
Michael, I thought Jim made one of the key points. In an election year, the point, and Julianne, we'll look at what Julianne suggested, but the proposal on the table certainly sounds like a tax increase on people who use Netflix, who use other streaming services, download their music digitally. That's interesting to try in an election year.
It's very interesting. I mean, it's something that when I look at this, I really start to think about net neutrality and where we're going with this with broadband internet services. The real issue around this is, and back to a point Jim made earlier, is around part of the agrarian access or issue. When we're talking about rural Georgia, we're talking about broadband access opens up various things. And one of the most important things is economic development. Economic development, educational services, there's telemedicine, there's all these things that are available through broadband access. The reason that broadband access isn't in these remote areas isn't because it's possible, it's because of the investment that these companies have to make to do so. So the real issue is going to be with how do we effectively expand broadband access, and I think the answer to that is going to be through new technology that we have. AT&T and several other companies are actually beta testing now broadband access that's much cheaper through a wireless access through true broadband up to a gigabit in speed that doesn't require digging and a lot of critical infrastructure costs that expanding broadband has.
And that's actually to your point here. The parallel, there's a parallel effort on the Senate, a somewhat parallel effort on Senate sponsored by Steve Gooch, which would allow the DOT to sell right of way along interstates,
yes,
to lay broadband cable. And the question, of course, there is to your point, is by the time you get that done, is that still going to be technologically first rate on the front, on the edge?
It's we don't know yet, but we know with AT&T and some other companies testing broadband access where they can actually use the top of telephone poles that already exist to bounce signal from one to the next. That's much cheaper than we know than digging in the ground. Well, and that really is the cost, right, of bringing broadband out to where it needs to
buddy,
go.
Buddy, I know you want to jump in, but very quickly to respond to what Julianne said, this would be a telecommunications tax, and it would cover phone TV services, including internet phones, satellite TV, which currently are not taxed, and then it would add the possible tax on streaming devices, digital music, and that sort of thing.
I'm probably demonstrating my lack of understanding of the new technology now, but it seems like this would be a great mission, a way to partner with the EMCs, the electric membership corporations around the state, who already have the infrastructure and who actually brought electricity to everybody in the state at one time or another. And I'm not sure how this could be partnered, but it seems like with the infrastructure and the ability they have already to deliver electricity, there ought to be some type of way that they could be partnered in using this existing infrastructure.
Let me go back to the political question. Heath, if you were working, consulting for a candidate for a state legislature in 2018, would you advise them to vote for what clearly is a tax increase in an election year?
You know, I'd always have a hard time, right? You talk about just the raw politics of it. If you're a Republican candidate in a primary or even in a close general election, any kind of tax increase will be used against you politically. We know that's the case. If you are going to do it, it definitely needs to be messaged correctly and put into a package. I mean, we have a couple of issues here. You're modernizing the current tax act, just like with retail brick and mortar stores versus online stores. They weren't contemplated when we passed the sales tax. And so there is a disadvantage to the brick and mortar stores. In this case, there's a disadvantage to all the companies that have been laying the fiber and laying the lines for these years. And you got all these what we call over the top companies that are benefiting from broadband but weren't caught up in it. So if it's a modernization and it's a consumption tax and the users who are benefiting get it, you can sell that message, but no matter how you sell it, it's going to be hard in an election.
And one of the most important things that's going to have to be done is the House is going to have to send out scouts into the Senate to see what their temperature is, whether they're even willing to consider this thing. Because David Ralston is not likely to put his members on the line with a vote for that bill, for or against that bill, if the Senate is going to kill it.
Great point.
That's a great point.
Yeah, Michael, it strikes me that if I'm a legislator in Americus or in Albany or in any more rural area of the state, I might be able to make an argument with my constituents that this is good for them. But if I'm a Republican in a Metro Atlanta district, I'm not sure that I would be willing to go out there and try to sell this to my constituents.
Yeah, I don't think so either. I mean, the huge disparity that we have between internet broadband penetration, right, between Metro Atlanta and rural Georgia is staggering, right? So if you're within an area where you already have it and you're saying, yeah, we need to pony up some money for those that don't, it's a very hard thing to do. What I would do is actually right now go back and look at this budget that the president has proposed and some of the federal laws that are already kind of tracking their way through and see if there's federal dollars that's going to come down the way for this.
Another quick item on taxing. Buddy Darden, there used to be a $5,000 tax credit if you bought an electric car in Georgia. The very same legislator who sponsored that bill in the first place came back 2 years later and said, no, it's too generous. We really can't afford it. But they eliminated it. The sale of electrical vehicles plummeted in Georgia as a result of the pulling away the tax credit. And now they're back with a $2,500 tax credit. Smart idea?
I'm not so sure. It didn't do too well last time because it turned out to be just a great vehicle for people to avoid taxes, and it cost the state a whole lot of money in revenue, and it didn't produce a whole lot of difference in lack of fossil fuels and so forth and so on use. So in my view, this is probably a sleeping dog that ought to continue to be asleep.
I don't know. I look. I've got to say that number one, that when it was in full force, we were I think number two in the nation.
Yeah, we were selling 10,000 electric vehicles.
Right, and you have to understand what the electric vehicle's position is vis-a-vis autonomous the autonomous vehicle movement. I mean, because that's kind of the pioneer. You can't have autonomous vehicles unless they're electric.
All right, well, one hand giveth, the other hand taketh away. Heath, at the same time that's being considered, it looks like there's going to be a change, if the bill passes, a change in how we tax used car sales. I tried to follow it, and I'm not sure I could explain it on the air, nor do I think we need to, except the bottom line is it looks like it's going to cost maybe $300 more to buy a car than it did if this particular measure goes through. So we're taking money away from people, giving it to them on the other hand. I don't get it.
Well, I think all of this argues, right, for comprehensive tax reform. And doing all this at one time is a lot smarter way to go about it. That's not how legislatures normally work. But again, I think what they're trying to get at is the fact that so many used car deals are now online and individual party. And again, it's you're discriminating. Some people are paying a tax and other people aren't. And if everybody goes and starts doing it this way, then you are losing revenue. And the question is, do you want tax fairness and equity and equitable treatment? And again, technology is changing the way we collect revenue.
Yeah. Julianne is nodding sagely at what you're saying.
Yeah, I don't have anything to add to that.
All right, I want to give everybody a chance here.
Well, Bill, let me point one thing out, is that the Georgia legislature, ever since Tom Murphy left, has been notorious for tax giveaways. And when you give it away to one group, then you add it to somebody else. And all of these tax breaks that exist now for every kind of thing, from private school tuition to electric cars to sales taxes on the Girl Scout cookies and goes on and on, all these might be wonderful, laudable things, but they start adding up after a while, and then everybody else's taxes go up.
All right. While we're talking about taxes, Jim, Political Insider, reported the other day that there's a fight brewing, already brewed, between two Republican candidates for governor, Hunter Hill and Casey Cagle. Hunter Hill is running on the idea of eliminating the state income tax. Casey Cagle thinks that's a bad idea.
Which I think we've got a couple other candidates who are at least saying that up front. But yeah, and what happened was that you had Mr. Cagle get on with Eric Erickson of WSB Radio for a half-hour broadcast. And in that broadcast, Eric brought up the topic of income tax. Florida doesn't have one. Tennessee doesn't have one. Why do we have one? And Cagle at first said he wanted to drop Georgia's income tax back. From it's now pretty much a flat 6%. Maybe make it 5.5 to 5. But he said the problem is, and this is where he said it calls to eliminate it or amounted to grandstanding. The state of Georgia is financially structured in a different way from Florida or from Tennessee. Like in Florida, Florida depends on tourists. They tack the bejesus out of them to get their money. 54% of the state income is from this income tax. So if you're going to eliminate the income tax, you either have to say what taxes are going up or what drastic cuts you're going to make.
All right. We'll watch and see how that plays out in the governor's race. I want to point out, Tom Faust just sent me a headline that we've just gotten in. As people begin to dissect the Trump budget, there's this. The Trump administration is funding the Mueller probe through the year 2019, Julianne, despite the fact that over and over again we hear the White House say, oh, this is about to wrap up. But you know what occurs to me, Julianne, without reading down in that headline at this point? This is one of those moments when, for all of the Democratic screaming about how Trump is trying to kill the Mueller investigation. He's trying to undermine Mueller, which he may be doing, I guess. They're funding him for another full year. That strikes me as a thing that maybe Democrats ought to be pleased about.
Oh, well, maybe he's hoping that they'll shift the focus to Uranium One. I mean, I'm sure that that's the hope.
All right, I'll tell you what. Let's get another break out of the way. And when we come back, we've got some more legislative business that we want to talk about and lots of other headlines that keep rolling in. This is Political Rewind. We'll be right back.
On the next Fresh Air.
When you think you're going to die, you really start to feel like you're fading to gray and everyone else is still in color.
Kate Bowler was diagnosed with incurable cancer in her 30s. She's married, has a young child, and teaches at Duke Divinity School. Her new memoir is about how her religion has affected how she deals with illness and how illness has affected her faith. Join us.
Fresh Air this afternoon at 3 here on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Heath Garrett, you wanted to make a point about really taking off on Galloway talking about the three-legged stool of revenue.
Yeah, when we talk about eliminating the income tax, one of the things we have to remember is Georgia's always had revenue from sales tax, property tax, and income tax. And while you might want to mess with one or two of those, you want to have a three-legged stool here, because during recessions, in particular during the Great Recession, states that did not have an income tax had much more drastic cuts and weaker economic activity than states like Georgia that had diversified revenue streams like this. So while you may want to modify it, I think it would be dangerous fiscal policy to talk about taking one of the legs of the stool completely out.
When it comes to eliminating the state income tax or rolling it back, Hunter Hill has touched a nerve with the conservative base of the Republican Party here in Georgia. The fact of the matter is, if you're going to keep introducing new consumption taxes and you don't roll back the state income tax, it's not going to sell. And the fact that our Republican legislators and the governor, as much as I respect him, are keep going forward year after year with corporate welfare and corporate giveaways. I mean, that's not selling well to the Republican base, but that is why that Hunter Hill has touched a nerve when it comes to rolling back the state income tax.
Georgia has long been considered a nationwide model for both vertical and horizontal tax equity. And don't forget,
I don't
know
what that means, vertical and horizontal. Help me with that,
about
please.
People paying what they should based on their income and everybody paying something. And don't forget, we have one other voluntary tax in this state known as a lottery. And so when you look at everybody pays something, but not everybody pays everything, I think Georgia pretty much stands in the middle of
I'll take up for Julianne here on this point, and that is in a Republican primary, people aren't thinking about the three-legged stool. All they're thinking about is April 14th, and paying their taxes and paying their state taxes, and if they can get rid of that state tax, you know, it's Casey Cagle is going to have to make that argument very, very carefully in order to preserve his lead in the GOP primary for governor, I think.
Except, Jim, the older citizens, the senior citizens who make up a large majority of Republican, not a majority, but a large number of Republican primary voters, pay very little state income tax, because most retirement income is exempt from state income tax.
But at the meetings that I go to, and those base Republican conservative base voters, and a lot of them that are there are senior citizens, are very much in support of rolling back the state income tax.
Michael, where do you see Democrats downtown fitting into a discussion about the state income tax? Or do you just stay clear of it?
I think you stay clear of it a bit, being in the minority, but it's simple math, right? And we look at the budget as a whole. By the time you take in school, public safety, caring for the elderly, you're at 80%, 85% of the budget. So something's got to go somewhere, right? You cannot keep giving away the cow and expect to get, you know, milk, basically.
All right. I want to change subject. And I apologize to all of you. This caught me completely off guard, and it probably will you as well, because Greg Bluestein just filed this story within the last about half hour on the Political Insider blog. bear with me. I'm going to read just a little bit of it because it relates to a very high-profile Republican member of the state legislature. The Democratic Party of Georgia called on Republican State Representative Betty Price to resign Monday after she insulted the looks and intelligence of high-profile Democrats and said one of the party's biggest achievements was, quote, the evolution of their women to have higher testosterone levels than many of the men. She apparently gave these remarks at a Fulton County GOP breakfast as she was describing the difference between Democrats and Republicans. And her remarks drew laughter. She talked about the beautiful and smart Republican women, Megyn Kelly, First Lady Laura Bush, Sarah Palin, Melania Trump. She then said, quote, the Democrats have Rachel Maddow, Roseanne Barr, Rosie O'Donnell, Whoopi Goldberg, Michelle Obama, Elizabeth Pocahontas Warren. And later on, Price is quoted as saying, liberal achievements include the invention of group therapy, the domestication of cats, group hugs, and the evolution of their women to have higher testosterone levels than many of the men. Well, it's great fodder for the Democrats, but I mean, she obviously... She knew her audience.
She knew. Look, I've been to many, many, many Republican breakfasts. I've heard worse. I think we're seeing a little bit of now that Tom Price is not a member of the Trump cabinet, is not heading up the Department of Health and Human Services. We are seeing kind of an unleashed Ms. Price.
Well, that's fine, but
is the thought right?
Yeah, on the weekend after the controversy over President Trump going to bat for Rob Porter against the ex-wives who've accused him of abuse, it strikes me this is another question. You know, I do have to start with you on this, Julianne. Are Republicans trying to turn women voters against them?
Well, first of all, I mean, I wasn't there. I am not going to make an argument for context in that one. But like you said, she was speaking to a certain audience. They were not, well, I guess they were public comments, but they weren't meant to be. I really can't make excuses for a lot of what she said. I wouldn't have said those things, and there are beautiful women in the Democratic Party, strong, beautiful women in both parties. And I think that when we get into the territory of starting to criticize one another's looks and we start getting personal with things, it does away with our intellectual integrity. And I don't approve of what she said.
Speaking of beautiful women in the Democratic Party, the long-suffering Lillian Darden and I having our 50th wedding anniversary this weekend.
Mazel tov.
And I'll go one step further except to say our friend Betty Price loves to insult people, and this is nothing new, and I don't think it ought to be given a whole lot of attention.
But I will say that, Bill, to your point, that this is kind of in the middle of a Me Too debate,
yeah.
And we see some real beads of sweat breaking out on people like Heath Garrett when they start looking down the road at November and where women are going to be putting their ballots.
I think that's so important. Michael, in 2016, 52% of white women voted for Donald Trump. Now, Trump he seems to have turned his back on women voters, and we're seeing a defection in terms of special elections that have come along since the presidential race. Yes. In Virginia, we saw that white suburban women turned against him. In Alabama, white suburban women turned against Republicans. And his behavior in terms of the Rob Porter incident seems to be tailor-made for Democrats to come along and woo those women who voted for Trump.
Yeah, I like to think so, right? I'm a little bit skeptical about it, but you know, it's like the gift that keeps giving in some way with this, right? But this thing with Betty Price, I'm taken aback right now. I mean, I'm not surprised, unfortunately, but it speaks to the just quite frankly, the nasty undertone, the underbelly of the thematics of this entire Trump campaign and where it's gone. And I last time I was on the show, there was a question about women empowerment, and I think this does everything against the women empowerment movement, not necessarily the Me Too movement, but the women empowerment movement as a whole. And Heath, I think you were on with me as well when we talked about this should not be a Republican. I mean, it should not be a Democratic move towards women empowerment. It should be on both sides of the aisle. And statements like this shows that, you know, the idea that women cannot be smart and powerful and intellectual, and their role is simply to be beautiful and cute and passive, feeds into a narrative that is completely against everything that the Me Too movement and the women empowerment movement stands for.
Let me ask you something, Michael. You had a Cobb County Democratic breakfast on Saturday, right?
Yes.
You had a lot of candidates and would-be candidates there. One of the things I'm going to be watching when qualifying opens on March 5th, it lasts the whole week, I want us to be tracking how many women candidates are signing up versus, say, 2 years ago or 4 years ago.
Sure.
Are you seeing a jump already?
I am seeing a huge jump. I'm seeing a huge jump in Cobb County, for instance. I could literally go through every House District seat, but we have overwhelming majority of candidates that are running in Cobb County are women, the majority by far. And these are women from all walks of life, some that have been engaged in politics for a long time, others that have just been engaged over the last year. But again, it speaks to that empowerment that I do not have to be a political junkie or an operative to have my voice heard and have an opportunity to go out and run an election.
Heath, you don't speak for Senator Isaacson, but you know him well. And certainly when he was here a couple weeks ago, he made it clear there are times when he just can't help. He didn't use this expression, but I'll use it on his behalf. Can't help but roll his eyes at some of the things that the president has said. What does this do to Republicans rank and file, you know, like your friend Senator Isaacson, you yourself and others who have, you know, been proud Republicans, proud conservatives for so many years?
Well, I think that these kind of comments, whether they're from the president of the United States or from a state representative or a grassroots activist anywhere in the state, you know, aren't helping if you're talking about winning elections, right? But from a pure right or wrong standpoint, what are we teaching our children about civility and politics and those kind of things? So I think this is one where good policy also makes good politics. We as Republicans all acknowledge that there's a growing gender gap in elections that we have to deal with. Julianne Thompson's doing a great job of recruiting women on the Republican side. I'm out there doing that myself. But this does give a lot of energy and excitement to political opponents of the conservative agenda.
Julianne, Michael talks about Democratic women coming forward. Are you seeing, is there a similar energization on the Republican side?
It could be stronger. It could be stronger. I'll be honest about that. I mean, I don't think that it's a shame that Karen Handel is our first Republican elected woman to the United States Congress. And we've got to see more of that. And
you're not saying that Karen Handel is a bad thing. You're just saying that it's
Karen
first
Handel
woman.
Is a wonderful yes, thing. What I'm saying is it's a shame. It's a shame that it took this long. It's a shame that it took, let it be known that I love Karen Handel. It is a shame that it has taken this long for the Republicans to elect a woman to the United States Congress. So I'm hoping that grows and, but...
Will it if the president continues this sort of behavior?
Well, it grew in the Democratic Party despite everything that happened Bill Clinton
right,
and everything
there.
That happened
I'll
Juanita.
I wondered how long it would take.
Let's be intellectually honest. I mean,
right.
Did the Democrats automatically believe Juanita Broderick and Paula Jones like they're blaming various Republicans for not believing the accusers? I mean, when you've done the exact same thing, you can't really throw stones.
Buddy, let me press you on that. You jumped in.
This is 2018, Bill. Now, you realize, Bill, this is 2018, and she's going back to 1994.
But it happened.
It happened in 1994, and this is 2018, and I think it's time that you, Bill, and some of these other people need to realize that this has been more than 25 years ago.
But let me tell you what Donald Trump never said. No, I'm not justifying it.
Well, the party that is totally against women and has made it very clear.
I am not justifying it. I totally and completely think that it's a terrible thing. But let me say this. When the presidential spokesperson, whether it's 20 years ago or not, when the presidential spokesperson, and I was in college when this happened, James Carville gets on national television and says, in response to a woman that accuses Bill Clinton, if you drag a $100 bill through a trailer park, you never know what you're going to get.
Yeah, I mean, this was a sorry.
So that justifies everything that's going on today. No. Is that
I
what
never
you're
said
saying?
It did.
Wait,
yes,
you
nope.
are?
All nope. Right. I,
all right.
I'm not.
All right.
I'm saying there's hypocrisy.
Yeah.
I totally agree.
All right.
Absolute abject hypocrisy.
All right, let's do this. we get how passionate people are on this subject. And so for that, I appreciate that. I would like to cool things down because this is Political Rewind. This isn't some Fox or MSN, you know, crazy show.
Real quick, Michael. I'll go back and say that this absolutely should not be a Republican versus Democratic thing. We should have smart, intelligent, hardworking women on the Republican side running for office as well. But it goes back to this, you know, Representative Price statement, right? If women are going to be seen as something less than feminine because they're strong and smart and assertive, that is a hindrance to women actually running for office.
Yeah.
We preach on the Democratic side that we need to find these women, seek them out, and encourage them to run.
All right. We're virtually out of time. I do have time for another quick item. Jim Galloway, you are a lover of history. Do you know what today is? This is Georgia Day. That's exactly right. On February 12th, 1733, James Oglethorpe and 114 colonists climbed 40 feet up a bluff from the Savannah River and founded the colony of Georgia.
As a non-slave state.
Exactly.
Which lasted, 2 weeks.
George II granted the trustees the charter, and you're right. It was to be a philanthropic and military enterprise that would provide the worthy poor a new start and serve as a buffer between Spanish Florida and the English colonies. By the way, that comes from the website Today in Georgia History, which is a product of the Georgia Historical Society. So, hey, happy birthday, Georgia.
Because this is an intelligent audience, we'll say non sibi sed alis, which is the original motto of the state of Georgia, not for self, but for others.
That's right. The Georgia Historical Society every year has a Georgia Day parade. And my wife, Janice Schaefer, and I were in Savannah on Friday for that parade coming out of the show we taped over there Thursday night. And we got to march with something like a couple thousand fourth graders who do this march every year dressed in colonist wardrobes, Indian wardrobes. And it was one of the most fun events we've been involved with for a long time.
I do need to tell people what our current motto is, and that's truth and wisdom in moderation.
All right. Well, congratulations on this Georgia Day, and thanks again to the Georgia Historical Society for a fun parade last Friday. That's it for us today. We thank you, Michael, Julianne, Buddy, Heath, and Jim. We will be back on Wednesday with another Political Rewind. Who knows what is going to happen between now and then? I'm Bill Nygut. See you then.